Although Blair Petrie's musical career has been hampered by bad timing, it's also been a long and in many cases very interesting one. Blair made his first inroads in 1973 with an improvisational group called Necromancer, a huge conglomeration of different musical styles and, over the years, musicians. Necromancer, unfortunately, were never committed to vinyl, but they were able to play many live gigs around Vancouver, mostly free of charge and with mixed audience reaction. This was probably due to the fact that some of the venues they played were extremely odd, most notably Pacific Center, when people were least expecting it. The range of music the group covered up to 1979, the year of its demise, is phenomenal. Jazz, prog rock, extended improvisations, avant-garde experimentation, and all of it very loud.
I always liked energy in music, and energy can be interpreted as being loud and aggressive, which Necromancer was a lot of the times, but as well as doing quiet acoustical things too, with flute and that. So there's so many massive contrasts in our music. I think that anyone who did hear us just was dumbfounded because they didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. You're saying, though, that when Necromancer did get a few gigs, the Arts Center, among other places, that a lot of Europeans who may have been in the audience came up and sort of clicked with what you were doing.
Yeah, the local people always would clap politely, but you just knew they really didn't know what was going on. But there'd be a lot of people that we had to do free concerts outside, like in the summer, and the parks, and we played at Pacific Center a few times when that first they had that stage out there. And actually, we ended up playing in front of some pretty big audiences. Sometimes there's 300 or 400 people there, or even more. And usually the response was pretty good, but most people, you know, a large segment of the audience, you could always tell, didn't know what was going on. But there were always the occasional people, either mostly, you know, any musicians in the audience would be very interested, obviously, in what we're doing. And there was a lot of amazed people that came up and said, wow, you know, never heard anything like this before. And I've never heard anyone play bass like that before. But there were, as you said, a lot of Europeans that would come up, and they thought that we were part of a whole scene that was going on in Vancouver that was doing that type of music, because coming from Europe, there are a lot of, you know, there's always a vibrant underground scene, or even an overground scene, like, of music that's, you know, there's so many different styles of music, so whatever you're into, you can go to clubs and see bands or musicians that play that kind of music. So they just assumed that we were just part of this local Vancouver scene, and that there's a whole thing, like sort of what it is now. There is a scene, an underground music scene now, but there, that time in Vancouver, there wasn't. I'm talking 1973 to about 1977, 78, you know, before the punk thing started, and sort of after the 60s, early 70s thing, it sort of fizzled out. There really wasn't any alternative music scene in Vancouver. I'm sure there were, you know, there's probably people out there listening going, well, I was in this band and we did that, this and that, but there was no connection between bands. There's nothing. I never even knew of any other bands that were doing anything like us, and I met a lot of musicians in that at that time, and we played a lot, and we talked to a lot of musicians who saw us who were just blown away because they had never heard anything like that. So obviously, if there were other people doing what we were doing, there weren't very many of them, and they certainly never played anywhere. So anyway, these people from Europe, getting back to that, would come, and they just assume we were part of this larger underground network, and we'd have to explain to them that, as far as we knew, this was it. And they'd be shocked, because where they come from, they'd see one band, and they thought we were like a doorway to some, you know, what's happening on the west coast of Canada or the United States, and we might have been a doorway, but to nothingness, unfortunately.
A brick wall behind the door.
Yeah, and so it was, I don't know, you know, Vancouver is a weird place. I like it here, but musically it's very narrow-minded. Even now, you know, people, there's a lot of good bands in that, and there's obviously talent and original ideas here, but people are so into what they're doing, and if you don't fit exactly into their little pigeonhole, they're not interested. They think it's garbage, and they don't want to have anything to do with it, and it's sort of defeating, you know, because sure, you're not going to like everything anybody else does, but at least you can sort of relate to them on some level. Like, I'm always open to different musicians and what they're doing, even if I'm not particularly, you know, personally, I wouldn't be particularly excited about playing in their band or anything, but I can appreciate them for what they do. But it seems very hard. People get so involved in their own little rut of music, and they won't look at anything else, and they won't be involved. Like, one of the things that sort of really killed the punk thing in Vancouver, which was very vibrant, was that none of the bands would cooperate. They were all essentially trying to achieve the same thing. They were playing music that wasn't acceptable to the, the corporations that control music in this country. You know, it was alternative music, and it was not acceptable for radio play. So they were all in the same boat. They were trying to get their music heard by the masses, and trying to get a message across. And for a while there was some cooperation, but after a while it just, you know, if you did this kind of music and it wasn't quite as, you know, raunchy as it, this band did, like, people started to pigeonhole everything, and there are those bands and these bands, and...
Well, it seemed to break down into cliques.
Yeah, it got so cliquey, and so they'd all hate each other, and that, you know, it's just like divide and conquer, and that suited every, you know, the big record companies and the radio stations and everyone just fine, because you just weaken your whole movement. I mean, there's no reason why someone who's into bizarre electronic sounds can't team up with a band that's into hardcore, because you're both on the same side of the fence doing the same thing.
Okay, we're still rolling. Okay, quiet everywhere, it's take four, rolling down.
After Necromancer disbanded in 1979, Blair turned his attention to other things, but still with the intention of playing bass. There was a failed attempt at punk called The Shriek, and an EP called Sex Sells, which came and went with little fanfare. He played contemporary jazz and dabbled in computer music with Paul Dolden, and went on to form the Rosa Luxemburg Band, which apparently sounded like a cross between Television and Romeo Void. His last project as a bass player came with the group Sex Beat, which was another lesson in bad timing. There were by then a flood of pop rock bands in Vancouver, and Sex Beat were only able to put out one EP before disbanding. In 1982, with the proposal of a cassette compilation of Vancouver electronic music, Blair contributed a piece to what became Stitching Small Tears, released by Alex Douglas and Peter Moser. That track was called Pamela.
I'm sort of getting back to more progressive minded music, I guess, slowly. I mean, it's not a conscious thing, it just seems to be. I think I've gone through my very accessible phase, and I'm including the record and even the tape to some degree. None of the things I ever did were really conscious decisions to be in Sex Beat. That wasn't a conscious decision to play commercial music and make lots of money. I mean, I just met these guys and I liked what they were doing, and I thought it had some potential to develop. Unfortunately for me, it didn't really develop the way I thought it could. So things are going to change. Like, the next project I'm doing, at Profile again, and they're going 24 channels, which is being financed by myself, DOA, and the Enigmas, basically, I think. There might be a few other people involved. We're paying them some money up front, and they're going to buy this 24-channel machine, which they're getting a very good deal on. And so what we'll get is all the bands I've mentioned, and whoever else, I guess, is involved. We'll get recording time for $15 an hour with a good engineer, which they now have. They have Mike Cords, who's, you know, he's quite a good engineer, and so for $15 an hour I can record in 24 channels, which is just unheard of. I mean, to give you an idea of what a good deal that is for someone like me, the cheapest 24 channels right now that I know of is about $100 an hour, and believe me, hours go by like seconds in a recording studio. And who's got $10,000 to record, you know, three or four songs these days?
Loverboy.
Well, I suppose. But they probably spend $200 an hour in their, you know, recording studios they go to. But So obviously there's nothing, either 8 channels or 24, and there's nothing in between that's accessible to people like me who want a better quality product but just can't afford it. So Profile is sort of, you know, this is great. It's great for them. It's great for the musicians involved.